Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
My name's John Wade. I'm a lawyer. I live in Australia. I became a mediator in 1987 in strange circumstances, partly out of disillusionment with some of the things I saw we were doing to some clients. They seemed to be worse off after we had tried to help them. And I then managed by serendipity to meet some outstanding mediators. And when I came back from training in Colorado, my law firm said, John, we're going to advertise you. So I fell in the deep water. I did some pretty bad things to start with, but slowly got better at it, and then got involved because I was also teaching at a university in training, and I've been mediating ever since. I have a queue of clients. I knock back about two-thirds of the people who are looking for me to do the work.
Just when you say knock back, what?
The phone call comes in, and they say, John, we need you to do this within the next 6 weeks, and the answer is, I'm sorry, I'm the wrong person. But here's three people I'd send my brother to or my sister to who I have a lot of confidence in. So I'm in a privileged position where demand has outstripped supply, which is very unusual in the mediation industry. And that's serendipity because I have my foot in one camp as a lawyer, so lawyers trust me. I have another foot in the camp called education, so I'm a communicator and I use metaphors and diagrams and people like that. And I've hung around. I haven't died yet. So in the mediation world, I'm known in certain cultures on the east coast of Australia.
And since you have all this free time, you also teach negotiation.
That's right, yes. So I've been fortunate to watch people in mediation. I don't think I'm instinctively a good negotiator at all. In fact, I think I'm below the line a long way. But for 19 years, I've watched really outstanding negotiators and not so good, and some who are part of the problem. So I have accumulated a toolbox out of that and been used now by my law firm to coach clients to negotiate, to coach in international bidding for particular contracts. And I really enjoy that, and I find it's a bit like learning to use a machine gun. You break down everything into bits and you help people to learn the bits, and then you try and put them back together. And sometimes that is helpful, sometimes it's not, but it's very interesting. And I've had the privilege then of meeting theoreticians from all over the world who bring their theory back to what you're doing, and that gives you these light bulb experiences, you say.
We should note that there's actually a group of theoreticians in the other room, and it sounds like they're having a very good time while we're you're recording this.
Absolutely. So we're in Rome, and there's a group of about 40 theoreticians who are very inspirational. Yeah,
they're talking about ways of teaching negotiation.
Exactly. So their challenge is how can you match the needs of customers all over the place? There seems to be a great need for negotiation training with their aspirations, which is to teach both theory and practice. And some of the customers are resistant to theory. They just want to know what to do on Monday. So how do you match this tension?
Well, it's interesting. Your approach to negotiation comes from not what's worked for you so much as what you've observed works for other people who appear in front of you, that you've been involved in mediating their disputes.
70% that, and then my law firm says, now, John, since you do this, help us get ready, and we're going to this meeting. You be the negotiator. And that's had some...
So you've had a chance to test it in practice
exactly,
as well.
Exactly, yes. Right. So I've been kicked in the head, and sometimes it's worked, and sometimes it hasn't.
Well,
yes.
Then let's talk about hard negotiations.
Okay, I'll change it to a hard negotiator to start with, and we could add many of the dimensions. Is a hard negotiator, and my definition, my working definition, is somebody who achieves consistently, not pub stories, not stories and cocktail parties, achieves consistency of emotional and commercial good results for clients or for himself or herself by use of a series of tactics and what might be called aggressive behavior. So many people say they're hard negotiators.
So it's dealing with a hard negotiator.
Okay. Well, I would say dealing with a hard negotiator is the response to this kind of person. If I met you and I identified you by reputation as being someone said, oh, Michael's a very hard negotiator, I would want to know what they meant by that, because many people like to be known as hard negotiators, but when you meet them, they're either cream puffs, they screw up their clients, or else they're only successful 1 in 6 cases, and they develop self-deception of, it's like poker machine players. I always win when I go in poker machines, right, and you discover when you ask around a bit more, no, they've actually sullied their ability to be a good negotiator because they're so well known for these standard behaviors that people dismiss them or they marginalize them. I'll go to the negotiation as long as Michael's not there, and then they become useless.
Right.
So it's very important, I think, to define what is a hard negotiator, and my definition must include statistically regular success, both emotionally for their clients and commercially, and they achieve success by a series of behaviors which most people in Hollywood would call aggressive or strategic.
Yeah, well, in an ideal world, I guess, you know, if you're able to say, I don't want to deal with Michael, or with, you know, that would be, if I could always dictate who's going to be on the other side of the table, I'd find it easy to eliminate the problem of the hard negotiator on the other side.
Okay, but one of the strategies that is common in my world is when I'm working with clients and we're dealing with the hard negotiator is, when won't he be present? When is he on holidays? Is he going to hospital for an operation? In other cultures,
help him get to the hospital for an operation.
Well, in other cultures, exactly. You hire 2 Tongan rugby players and they break his leg. So in other cultures, it would be, how can we eliminate...
Not by the way, a technique that we're recommending on this podcast.
Absolutely not. But it's the concept of, you isolate the hawk. And that's people have been doing that since 60,000 BC, so there's nothing new here, but that's a very standard response. And another way is to publicly announce, try and humiliate them within the organization. You phone Michael C.
And you found that to be an effective way of working with hard negotiators.
Absolutely, yeah. It's in your toolbox. You have to ask, will it have more counterproductive results? But you phone Michael CEO, or you have, it's part of a conscious strategy. You meet Michael's accountant, and you say to the accountant, this will be fixed when Michael's not there.
Because I guess if they're hard, I guess the idea being if they have a reputation for being a hard negotiator, if they're aggressive with you, they've probably been aggressive with other people.
Absolutely. The past predicts the future.
Right, right.
And that's one of the strange things about this is once you're known, you're named and you're weaker, because it's like the tennis player who's only got the drop shot. Well, once it's known, then the reverse play is you work out a package of reverse plays.
It sounds to me like that is a very dangerous strategy if you're not confident that your relationship with the other organization that you're negotiating with is stronger than that organization's relationship with the difficult Michael, to use the example of me.
Yes, and so that comes back to, will we drop that one altogether out of our toolbox? It's in our toolbox if we decide the risk is too high. Or will we have a softened version of it, which is we coach the person to go to the accountant and with raised eyebrows, not with a set of words, to say, wave their hands, raise their eyebrows, say, well, we are having some difficulties.
Right. So maybe not saying it explicitly, but giving a hint that, you know, that maybe we could do a deal if that person wasn't involved.
Yes.
Well, you know, it sounds like this is also something you need to be very attuned to cultural situations where, if within a particular culture, the relationship of the person within the company, and for example, a very hierarchical organization may say, I've put Michael in that position, that's Michael's job, and therefore I've placed trust in him. And that if you come to me as the organization and say, I'm going to challenge Michael's authority or his competency to negotiate this matter, the answer may be, well, then we'll go negotiate with somebody else.
Exactly. And I might have to have as I'm a professional persuader, I might have to say, as you know, all CEOs, all middle managers are multi-skilled, but they're not 100% on every skill. So this person you've got working here is 100% on 6 of the skills, but there's a 7th one where some push-ups are needed.
And it's keeping us from getting to the deal. Let's talk about a situation where we don't know in advance that we're going to be having to deal with a hard negotiator, but we find that out when we get to the negotiation.
Okay, I'll give you an example I just did a few weeks ago. Law firm being sued for professional negligence. The law firm has given advice historically which we would call optimistic.
Right.
Arrive at the negotiation and they have a bank of lawyers. The litigation partner who didn't give the advice is screaming, waving his arms.
We like to do that, that's
right. Yeah.
Us litigation lawyers.
He's convinced that he is right in rights talk. He has got a long list of arguments about the law of negligence, didn't cause the client loss, it's the client's problem, the client was aggressive. Nice legal arguments.
All right, so I did, standard argument, I didn't do it, but if I did, I don't owe you anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so he is a hard bargainer with a lot of emotion, either feigned, so you arise, is this feigned, or is this his deep feeling, or as he began feigning, and now he actually feels it. So he's, in our world, he's blah-blahing rights talk. And he's not going to give this client a penny. The answer is naught, and the client has got a six-figure number saying, it must be there, it must be there. So they've got the standard gaps, and that's going nowhere, and it never will, because his ego's involved, and his actual reputation in the community as being a good litigator is involved. So his interests start to continue the conflict. So what do? You can sit there and you can try and clarify the legal arguments. Could you in 15 minutes clarify your legal arguments? Could you in 15 minutes clarify the others? So you can clarify, and that is of some assistance in the fog of war. But it's unlikely, because of the other interests that the lawyer has got, that he's going to move even when the clarification takes place.
And at this point, the negotiations between the parties are actually driving them further apart.
Absolutely. Yeah. The more you clarify, the more he's convinced he's got good rights, blah, blah, good rights predictions.
Right. So we're dealing with a very difficult party here, because the more the negotiation goes on, the longer or the farther apart the parties are now becoming.
And you have the dilemma of transaction costs are moving faster than the offers made. So the transaction costs are kicking up the gap, because the client keeps saying, and now I have spent another $100,000 on my new lawyer pursuing you because you're playing hard to get. So the gap's widening faster than the offers. So how do you respond to that? So in that particular case, the key thing, you have to split the team. So the way to deal with a hard bargain, you've got to find a team and then split them. So the key person in the room is the managing partner of the law firm. He is the key. But unfortunately, his interest is to keep friends with this other partner. He's got to go back and work with him.
Right.
He doesn't want to double-cross him. So your goal as a negotiator, or if the mediator's involved, is to try to isolate the managing partner and say, what's important to you? And then ask the risk question, what if this conflict continues for another 2 years? And because he's smart, he'll say, number one, our name will be in a newspaper on a website somewhere, so we will lose business because of this. Number two, I'll be diverting my employees to manage this, so I've lost opportunity costs. So you've got them up on the board. You make it very visual as a negotiator, because you're working with what's called the moderate, who's got different goals. And you put numbers on them. So what's it worth to you to avoid bad publicity for 2 years? What's it worth to you? And you make him put numbers on. You say, I want numbers, I want numbers. Let's not just waffle about this. So he gives you minimal numbers. He says, well, we'd lose at least 5 clients, $100,000 each, that's $500,000. Yes, we'd lose minimum $500,000. Diverted work time for how many employees? Well, probably 30 employees each working at this, multiplied by the square root of 7, at least $100,000. So we're up to $600,000. If you walk out of this room, you are going to set fire to $600,000.
So finding a moderate voice or a moderate person on the other side and making them confront what I guess the negotiation would be their BATNA, you know, bringing out the BATNA and making it transparent as to it.
Much more important, I think the word BATNA is unhelpful in negotiations. In conflict negotiations, the key is to work out the range from best to worst. So to even work out your BATNA is part of the delusion of I have a fallback.
Right.
No, you don't have a fallback. Life's not that certain. You've got a range. You've got what could happen on a good day, what could happen on a bad day. He's given me his good day.
Right.
He said, $600,000 gets set fire to as I walk out of this room. He hasn't even talked about the bad day.
That's his good day.
That's right. His good day. Right. So as a negotiator, you can say to the moderator, so you've got $600,000 to give away. They don't like that conclusion, but that's an economic truth.
Because it's in conflict with the rights argument they've just put forward.
Yeah. So the moderate says to you on the other side, that may be true, John, but you've got to help me with Bill. Because if I do this diagram to him, he's gone ballistic. Because he's got the number naught up there. We've just come to the number 600,000. So help me sell this to my hawk. And so then it's back to, well, do we either wait for another meeting when he's on holidays? Do we come back now and give him flattery as one of the standard ways of dealing with stonewallers? They can't really manage flattery. Most males can't manage flattery. And tell him how wonderful...
Well, if you want to say something nice to me, fine.
And so tell him how wonderful he is, how his legal arguments are very attractive, how probably they would get up down the track in World War III, and that his reputation in the community is excellent. And this is one of those horrible commercial deals where other things are prevailing and we ask, please help us out here. And try and flatter him into saying, even though it's a hard pill to swallow, there are other things here than rights. And in that particular case, which I've just given the illustration, that was successful. Much against the hawk and the rights speech, the economic speech, the goal speech, eventually won. But the major negotiation is within the team, not across the team.
So it sounded like what happened in this case is that you began, you know, maybe with one or more people on the other side to begin to develop a consensus that went against the hard negotiator, the difficult person, and use them as your leverage or your lever to get into the hard negotiator, and then you find ways to bring them around so they can join up with everybody else.
And that you can help them save face for their interest as being a good person, a helpful person, a professionally competent person.
So in dealing with the hard negotiator, it's important to allow them a way out in which they save face.
But ultimately, you may leave them fairly embittered people because that's one of the costs of splitting the team.
Because they didn't get their way.
They didn't get their way. Because another standard way of splitting the team is to draw a single-page diagram. People are very influenced by single-page diagrams. And distributing those amongst the team beyond the hard partner. And this simple diagram, pie chart, 3 arguments, 4 weaknesses, 3 costs, becomes part of the culture of conversation with his friends or her friends. And that's a form of splitting the team. They say, look, we've seen this risk analysis. What do you think? And they, of course, don't like this because you are trying to cause their team to turn against them. So it's another one of the strategies. Single page, distribute it, get it to the other side, meet them for coffee, and get it into the hands of multiple what we call tribal members, groups that are around there.
Right. Mm.
So these sound like dirty tricks, but they're just part of decision making.
When you have just one person, and that person is a hard negotiator, and by hard negotiator it sounds like it can be either highly aggressive, or I guess a hard negotiator could also be someone who maybe just isn't very intelligent.
And exactly, yes. The most fearful negotiator, Michael, is the person who says, I don't care. And the phrase is, I have nothing to lose. I don't care if I lose my money. I don't care if I lose my business. They're truly terrifying people because that's one of the bases of terrorism is you can't hurt me. And those people, if you identify that as more than bluff, if you do your diagrams and let's sit with your client and say, how realistic is this speech that you can't hurt me? Then the answer is give in. The answer is just give in, give them what they want, and get out, move away from them. They're too strong because most of us have got mortgages, homes, jobs, reputations, hopes for the future. The real hard bargainer says, I have none of those and I don't care. And so if you don't identify that person, then you're in trouble.
Well, again, it sounds like in this case we're saying don't negotiate. Then if you can't get somebody to be reasonable, then you can't negotiate with them.
No, the reverse of that is and I think language is important here, is the other strategy for a hard bargain is just pay them what they want, which is either the phrase pay them a premium or give them a discount. If they've got the only turbine which has this particular characteristic and scarcity has made it very high priced and they double the high price,
what we say it's the cost of raw materials thing.
At that point, don't destroy your own commercial goals by getting into competition with the hard bargainer. If you feel you're being screwed, but your goals are to use that turbine in this particular factory in the next 10 days, then pay the premium.
In other words, don't let the fact that you're dealing with a hard negotiator, a hard bargainer, lead you into thinking that you're not getting, not do the deal that maybe you should do.
Exactly. Focus on yourself and
Focus on your own goals right now.
Not on the fact that that person...
That the hard negotiator is using unfair tactics to get what they want.
Exactly. Or that they're making an undue profit, or in the talks of this litigation partner, but she doesn't have those rights. You say, well, don't focus on her. Look after your own law firm. But it's not fair, he says. Right. This is outrageous. She's blackmailing. So the language, she's right. Blackmailing us. Right. The answer is, who cares? Look after your own law firm.
Well, another way of looking at it may be that if you know that your best day is $600,000, to use your example of earlier, if you can get out of that negotiation with $300,000.
They got out for $301,000. Oh. And so the speech is, yeah, this is a pre-Christmas bargain. Yeah. Just give a $301,000. You are making $299,000. You reframe the talk. The managing partner says, "Yeah, this is a bargain." For him, his thought is zero, so he was getting screwed. So he was paying out too much. So he found it very difficult to reframe this to, "We are getting a pre-Christmas bargain."
Well, that doesn't sound terribly different from, to me, almost any commercial negotiation that you would want to get involved in, because you're going to try to assess, what is my alternative? If then it is bad, to an extent. What happens to me if I don't do this deal?
Exactly.
And I got to understand what my options are. If my options are, in the best case, I'm going to pay $600,000, then really what I ought to be able, unless there are other principles at stake or other reasons, from a purely commercial point of view, in treating this transaction as a one-off, I ought to be happy with anything that's $599 or below that.
Exactly. And so that's one of the things I end up getting hired for, not because I've been trained for it, but as a mediator, I have people come to see me and we just do a risk analysis before they go to a negotiation. And the key to a risk analysis, in my experience, is visuals. And because I'm a lawyer, lawyers don't like visuals. So clients do, especially engineers or architects or builders, they love visuals. And so I just sit in a room and we draw a line down the middle of the page and we say, heading, what are the risks if you don't get this deal? And we write, brainstorm there, your risks. And then we make guesses about the other side. What are the risks if the other side doesn't get the deal? And the visualization of it often flip-flops the whole perception of power. We finish the risk list and you've got 15 and they've got 3. And it sits there. And staring everyone in the face and say, now put dollar signs on all those risks. And all of a sudden people say, we're getting out of this. Whereas before they came in saying, we're very strong, they need us.
Yeah, although, you know, I have to tell you that this to me reflects also something that I have seen very often in disputes, almost anywhere in the world, in a universal phenomenon of disputes, is that many people go into a settlement negotiation without having defined either a goal for the negotiation or a bottom line. And they go in with an open mind. I come here, we're going in to listen and see what the other side has to say. Well, I mean, I think that you're setting yourself up for failure if you say, I'm going in to listen, rather than saying, I'm going in to get something.
Exactly. I agree with that, yes. And if you go in to listen, you too quickly fall into a competitive mindset where you're not wanting competitive mindset, you're wanting to achieve your goals. Right. So how can you achieve them until you have... And a goal is a flip-flop of a risk. So I find that lawyers, we've been trained to talk in risk talk, the risk of delay, the risk of diverted opportunity, the risk of expenditure, whereas business people talk in goal. We want to have this project finished on this day. We want to have good relations for the next 3 deals. So as a negotiator, I think you need to be able to flip-flop your conversation from risk talk to goal talk.
Well, in fact, I think that, if you were to ask me who are the hard negotiators that we deal with, the difficult bargainers, they're not people who are unintelligent. I think we deal with fairly sophisticated people on the other side, and they're not people who I think are innately unreasonable for the most part. The problem that we have often, and fairly often, is that we get into a dispute and it goes off into a track, and you deal with people who have, they don't have a goal. And, you know, in the business world, winning a litigation, that's a legal goal. It's not really, it's not a commercial goal. It's a legal goal. And if you go into a settlement negotiation with people who haven't got a a predefined set of what they hope to achieve, it's very hard in a settlement discussion to reach that, because it just the discussion deteriorates quickly into why am I right and why are you wrong. And it's almost a mini arbitration rather than a what can we do to make this thing work.
Now, one of the skills of a good negotiator is that I see amongst some very, very good lawyers is, let's have that blame talk. Could we have it for how long would you like? Let's have a blame talk for 30 minutes, and then we'll put that aside and see if that's helped us and see where we go to from there. So they acknowledge the blame talk is worthwhile, but they put a time limit on it. We're not going to stay here and wallow in who's responsible for the missing part, and we'll finish that talk, and then we'll get on to other things. Just a couple of other words you used there, which as a mediator with my other hat, if anyone ever uses the word win, I always interrupt and say, Michael, at this meeting I prefer no one uses the word win. Win's something that's used in basketball. This is life. You don't have winners in life, you have complex situations, so I just won't. And then the other one you use, though used in different contexts, is the word principle. When someone says it's a matter of principle, I always just interrupt, I'm not polite, and say, we don't use that phrase principle in these meetings. If you can tell me what the principle is, then we'll use it. So if the principle's revenge, we can discuss how to hurt someone. If the principle's, I never want this to happen again, we can discuss that. But I don't want that either of those words used in this room. And that's, again, it's a bit of an attempt to change the rhetoric and the self-deception.
No, you to get people focused on goals that can be achieved. I do the same thing internally in our discussions, and depending on which part of the world I am, if it's in Italy, I may say, when people say, well, we can't do this just because it's not right, and I say, well, if you're more concerned about what's right than the bottom line to the company, maybe you should have become a priest rather than a business person.
Okay. Well, in Australia, just so you know, also the definition of the bottom line is my best offer till I make another one. Thanks, yeah. Michael.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.